listening to Ink and Paint Girls, a podcast celebrating women in animation, where we discuss the ups and downs of making a career for yourself. Today, we're speaking with Esther Pearl, founder and executive director of Camp Real Stories, a media camp for teenage girls who want to learn how to make movies in the new digital age, located in Oakland, California. So Esther has about 15 years experience working in production management in the entertainment industry, mainly at Pixar Animation Studios, where she worked on movies like The Incredibles, WALL-E, and Monsters, Inc. She has also worked on live-action films like Titanic, Armageddon, Starship Troopers, and What Dreams May Come. I am so thrilled to finally interview her and to learn more about her journey from live-action visual effects to animation to going to grad school and then starting a non-for-profit organization. I mean, who does that? Esther Pearl does that. Thank you, Esther, for coming on the show.
My pleasure, Kat.
Would you mind just, like, saying your name and some things that you have done, just giving an overview of what you do now? We'll get into everything else.
Sure. My name is Esther Pearl. I'm the founder and CEO of Camp Real Stories, which is a media camp for girls. Our mission is that when women and girls are better represented behind the scenes in the media, they'll be better reflected on the screen. And my previous life before running this nonprofit was in media. I worked in animation at Pixar Animation Studios for about 8 years, and before that in visual effects in L.A., and then even before that, I worked on my first commercial when I was 16 years old. So I was hooked as a teenager in media.
What was it that hooked you to the media?
Well, I was raised in Santa Cruz, mostly Santa Cruz, California, by my parents who never owned a television set. So I think it was definitely a great act of rebellion that I was never allowed to watch media. And so when I was 16, I did an internship at a Democratic consulting firm in Washington, D.C. I think my family had high hopes I'd go into politics. But while I was there, I got to work on political commercials. And it really was the ability to tell stories and connect with such a wide audience that was really exciting to me.
Oh, wow. That's really cool. What happened after, is politics, like, run in your family? Is that why they wanted you to go that way?
Yeah. I definitely would say that, I mean, both my parents held, like, local political offices, but we were raised, my siblings and I, with an understanding of being a global citizen. So we were raised in two countries. We moved every other year between the United States and Australia. And in both places, my parents were great activists for social justice. So it was really an exciting way of being raised. It was also a very different way of being raised. I craved my friends' houses that had MTV and Atari and things that were not going to happen in our home.
Yeah.
So I think it's, you know, when you're a young person, as a mother now of raising young people, I realize you just always want what you don't have. It doesn't matter what you have. Everything always than what you have.
Grass is always greener.
Yes. And then you look back and say, what was I complaining about?
Yeah. So, did you ever, so like, you worked at Pixar for a while in production management. Did you ever think that you would be working at an animation studio before you got there?
You know, I started at Pixar in 1999, so they'd only made a couple films at that time. Toy Story and A Bug's Life, Toy Story 2 was in production then. And so before that, I was at a visual effects company in L.A., and I really loved the visual effects world. I had some really great teams of people that I worked with.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what attracted me to Pixar mostly was it was in the Bay Area, which is somewhere where I really wanted to be. And they had made some great, the films that they had made were such great, great stories. And they connected with so many people on so many levels, which was really exciting to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was the challenge of something that's new and that was unknown. I crave that as I look back now in my 40s and look back on my career, that stability and knowing where the what's going to happen next is not something that makes me feel comfortable. It's mostly like the infinite possibilities. So I think it was less about Pixar being an animation studio and that being the medium that was exciting to me, as more as like, what would that future be? Mm-hmm. Which is really what attracted me to visual effects as well. I was mostly excited about that idea of creating something out of nothing, and that you're only bound by the constraints of the talent of the people around you. And yes, that still has to fit into a really good story, because you can have as many bells and whistles as you want, but without a story, you know, some people will come. I mean, certainly we see a lot of films out there that have a lot of bells and whistles and don't necessarily have a great story, but, you know, you really kind of need both of them.
I think that's awesome, because I feel the same way about, like, you know, you have the story and then you find the perfect medium for it. And that sounds a little like that.
Well, I think also when maybe not being in these roles in a creative position, I think it really comes down to the environment as well. And both Pixar and the studios I worked at in L.A. before that, it was just such an incredible group of people. Mm-hmm. And there's just something about, you know, my mother always told me, you are the company that you keep. So if you're keeping some great company, you're going to produce some great work. Or you're going to be able to get through the bad times. I mean, one of the things about working in visual effects is sometimes you just work on some really inane commercials, or you work on some really mind-numbing movies, but they're very short, you know, maybe 3 or 4 months. In the studio that we worked at, I know many other studios are different. So you really have to enjoy the people that you're working with, because it can be painful otherwise. And I've been lucky enough to, you know, really say that I've kept some great company.
You said that you worked on a lot of commercials and stuff, and that's a lot more not as stable as animation, right? Like the way you were working in L.A.? Was it job to job?
No, I worked for one studio, so it was called POP, and then it merged with a French Canadian company called Buzz Effects, and then it became, you know, I think as happens in these smaller studios, they merge and their names change a lot. So we were constantly working, but it was for one company, so it wasn't. I don't have the constitution for a freelancer's life. Mm-hmm. I need to know where my next paycheck is coming from. So I think if you have that ability and constitution, I think that that's fantastic, because you think it opens up a lot of doors of possibilities for you. Mm-hmm. It was definitely a little bit more of my own fear. I didn't have a safety net to fall into. But it also gives you an opportunity to really cultivate and craft a great group of people that you're working with, because you're working on the same project over, yeah, same group of people on different projects over and over again.
So to you, because I've worked with a few producers and production managers, and they all have very similar styles, but they also have, there's also a lot of differences. What would you say is, what's your philosophy on production management and, you know, coordinating artists and talent?
My philosophy is to raise the set the bar and standards of expectations pretty high, and hopefully people will meet them. And, you know, you hire people to do the job, so let them do it. I mean, I look at, especially with a lot of the artists I've worked at, it's a little bit of cat herding, but they're incredibly talented. And so I think when some producers get into it, a style of micromanaging, I can say, also being married to an artist, you're not going to get very far. So, you know, giving people the space and breath and trust for them to do their jobs, but also helping them set, you know, good parameters and let them know where the bar is set so that they can. It's pretty rare. I don't think that most people want to do the worst possible job. I think most people want to do the best possible job, but they need to know what that would look like. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, at like a place like Pixar, where it's just some of the best of the best, sadly, I just don't think everybody
has that ability to do that great of a job.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay. You know, they could, there's a lot of roles out there for them. But I think you have to explain to them what a good job looks like. And then, and whatever that beat is, like, this is what the director expects. You know, this is the time frame that you have to work in. And mostly, with me, it was, and it's sort of key in my life outside of, you know, my professional life, my personal life, just good communication. If you are running behind or things have come up taking longer, it's not the end of the world as long as someone knows that. I've had the, you know, I've had the great fortune to have a lot of really incredible mentors, and one of them told me a long time ago, it doesn't matter if you get something done and no one knows about it, because everybody else thinks you haven't done it yet. So, yeah. You know, communicating that you are finished with something or communicating what done is, I think those are really key pieces of information that people need to be on the same page about. And that's always a big one for me. It's like what I think done is as a producer and what an artist may think done is, maybe two different things, but we need to be clear about what done and finished are.
Mm-hmm.
So I think my philosophy is that just try to set people up for success as much as possible. Makes your life a lot easier too.
Yeah. In producing visual effects and animation, could you go through like what the differences were and similarities?
In visual effects, I was never a producer. I was a coordinator working with a team of producers. Normally, our studio was hired by another like major studio to finish shots on a film.
Mm-hmm.
I think the big difference, just as an industry, in my experience, is that visual effects moves, it's just fast and iterative and down and dirty. Normally, by the time visual effects artists get to work, the trailers are already in the theaters. You have to be able to be, and I found that work very exciting because you had to be very creative on how you were going to get things done.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody had to be creative from a producing point of view, from an artistic point of view. And animation, especially at Pixar, the films, you know, they're perfectionist dream, but they take 5 to 6 years. So it's much more of a marathon. You have to learn how to pace yourself. Because if you burn out in the first year, it's not going to, you're not doing anyone any good.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be a frustrating process for a lot of people. It was a frustrating process for me and a lot of times. I'm like, I know that there's a faster way to do this. And that's not necessarily what animation or that studio wanted. And also, I think in fairness, they were like, we got this. we're pretty good at what we do. So, you know, trust the process. And so that can be a hard process to trust the first time you go through it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I don't know if I can answer like what the day to day.
Oh no, that's okay.
It's bizarre mostly because it's been so long since I've done one.
Yeah, no, that's great what you said. So it sounds like you had to learn how to pace yourself after working at Pixar with the different workflows, it seems like, between visual effects and animation. Like, what was the process of you figuring that out?
Well, I don't know if I've ever learned. I mean, that's sort of like, do as I say, not as I do.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've ever learned how to fully pace myself. I like to work hard. And I like, so I think my process personally was having a lot of personal stuff happen in my life where the choice was made for me. I had to learn how to pace myself because I was done. I was taxed, entirely. And it can be hard to make that transition to saying no and putting up more boundaries about your time. You know, I was also a lot younger, when I was in my 20s. I loved working until 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night. Now that I'm in my 40s and I have a family, that's not interesting to me
mm-hmm.
at all. So I think it's also learning who you are and knowing who you are at that time in your life. So I think it's just trying to be really true to yourself. I think it's, I think when you're younger, you should work really hard.
Yeah.
Because when you're older, you don't have the energy to do it. So you don't want to look back and say, I didn't, and I don't necessarily know if that, and I would say, you know, for women in particular, you know, often we have to work harder already in the industry, and that can seem really unfair, but you shouldn't also be afraid to put yourself out there and, you know, push yourself a little bit harder and work a little bit harder to reach your goals and achieve what you want, and not to second guess yourself, because I think we can sometimes be our own worst enemy. A little bit of ignorance, it can be bliss in that time. I don't know how hard it's going to be, but I'm just going to try.
Yeah.
You'll figure it out.
Why do you think it is harder for women?
Well, I think it's still an industry that I don't think. I know it is still an industry where women are tragically underrepresented. I think it's really great that in 2015 it started becoming more of a cultural conversation, and hopefully in 2016 we'll start seeing a shift. But really there are very few women behind the scenes in the media. 16% of decision makers in the industry are women.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're often one or two or a small handful of women in a room, you know, just to be seen and heard may take more of an effort than you feel comfortable or feels authentic to you. And then on top of that, to have to prove yourself to, you know, a group of sort of close-knit group of people can seem like a lot of effort. And so, and it is a lot of effort. And I do feel like truly the stakes are higher. If you make a mistake as a woman in the industry, it can be a lot harder to rebound from it. And I think I know that that's not nearly as hard if you're a white male.
Did you, so you know from experience, because you've often been one of the few women in the room.
You know, I think I've always noticed the problem on some level. As I said, I was definitely raised by a feminist. I am a feminist, but I don't know if I really started to tangibly connect the dots to what the issue was. I mean, I certainly noticed, like, the poor portrayal of women in the media, and I noticed how excited I would get when I'd watch a movie or a story, television episode where there was a woman I could relate to, and I'd be like, why is this so moving to me, and realizing, because it's a rare occurrence. But I don't think I really started, and because my own career had, even though I was one of the few women in the room, I didn't, you know, I would sometimes feel left out, but I don't think I can say I was discriminated against in any major capacity ever. And I had a lot of great mentors, both female and male, throughout my career. And so I think I was more curious at, like, why am I the only woman in the room? I've played sports very poorly growing up. I was always the only girl playing, and I had three older brothers. So I a lot comfortable being around a group of guys. But it didn't really start to connect the dots until I became a parent myself. So when my daughter was one, and I really started to, like, look at children's media and just be horrified that it was the same sort of princess tropes or the same manic pixie dream girl that I saw growing up, and I hated when I was a little kid. And now I really didn't want my daughter being raised, this being the only representation she saw, or the only role models or ideals that she could look up to were being the ones represented in the media. So that was really when it started to, like, for me, that there was a great opportunity for change here.
Was it when you started doing that after you had your daughter? Is that when you decided to do something about it?
Yeah, so I made the very lucrative decision to have a one-year-old leave Pixar and go to a graduate school no one had ever heard of. So then I got my MBA in 2010. And then by the time I'd finished my my two-year program, which took me 3 years because I had a second child in the process of doing that. And the program focused on sustainability, and my focus was on social sustainability. So I really wanted to look at how gender and media and lack of diversity in the industry played a role in influencing our young people's decisions and choices.
Wow, that's really amazing. I mean, I assume that that was a really tough decision.
Well, now I'm looking back on it. I'm like, no, it wasn't a tough decision at all, but I'm sure it was awful. but it was all worked out. I mean, I think, honestly, the decision to go to grad school was such a, I can only imagine it as, you know, I'm not a deep believer in these things, but sort of a faith-based decision where I was questioning what I wanted to do. I had a small child. My husband's also in the film industry. It can be a tough industry to raise a family in just because of the hours that you put in. And I happened to be in Antigua, Guatemala, which is not anywhere near here, and I went to a lecture on sustainable business. And I was like, this is totally what I want to be doing. And I came back to the United States, and there's the Presidio School of Sustainable Business Management, which is the only sustainable business management program in the United States that was in my backyard. So It seemed like it was all, like, lined up. And while I was there, it just became very clear that so many of these industries that I align with values-wise, like environmental organizations and social justice organizations and people who are doing really amazing things to create incredible change in our society are some of the worst storytellers in the world. And I felt like here's where the media really, you know, people can sort of mock Hollywood and entertainment, but there's no denying that this world has an opportunity, has a finger on the pulse of what goes on in society. Millions of people, billions of people probably watch Star Wars in the month of December, and you know, and so I mean, you have these opportunities to connect with humanity on such a wide swath of people. And really, I felt like these culture changers and change agents should be looking at, frankly, commercials a lot more than they ever do. And so it was sort of there that I really wanted to figure out where the shift could be made between entertainment and education and storytelling and, you know, these worlds that kind of seem diametrically opposed are really much more alike, or they should be more alike, and they should be more aligned than they are. Kind of heady and academic, I know, but it's exciting as well.
No, that's really interesting. Like, so when you were at the Presidio school, like, did you know you wanted to create Camp Real Stories before you went there, or was that out of your work in school?
No, that was out of my work there. I mean, honestly, I got there and you had all of these environmentalists and design thinkers and social change agents, and I felt pretty intimidated that I made movies. And within, like, my second semester, I was like, oh, no, you people really need to make movies. You know, I mean, it was just like, you know, and it was very much sort of the life I was raised in, where, like, well, I don't even own a television. Like, well, then your idea is not ever going to go anywhere. You know, because mocking hundreds of millions of people in the United States, like, television is a very important way that we connect in a lot of ways. And there's a lot of great things that happen there, and there's a lot of bad things that happen there. Mm-hmm. But by acting like you're better than it, you're not going to move the needle in any way. So it was there that I had, you know, I had the opportunity while I was in the graduate program to do things that you don't normally get the opportunity, which is spend 6 months studying gender in society. And I think we all know we have a long way to go, especially in the United States, for equity in gender. And I think at that time there was a lot of discussion, I mean, there still is a lot of discussion around women in tech. And for me, not being in the tech industries, I wanted to see where something that made sense to me, which is an industry I knew, also had the same issue, and if we can sort of, you know, I wanted to be solution-oriented. Where can we find a solution? Where can we create, like, a little bubble of change because what I saw out there that existed was just report after report on how bad it was. And I don't necessarily, that didn't inspire me to want to do anything differently. So how do we change that story? How do we change that dialogue into, all right, what can we do about it?
Mm-hmm. Why did you choose Oakland to be the home base?
Because I live here. I mean, a lot of it was the very first year I did, our very first summer for Camp Real Stories was 2013, and it was just a test. It was a pilot. I didn't know if anybody was going to care. I didn't know if anyone was going to show up. And so, you know, it was like, what is the path of least resistance for a pilot? And so that first year was, you know, the local arts high school asking them if we could host it there. It ended up being that the chair of the digital media program at Oakland School for the Arts is a woman who's now my board president. Mm-hmm. And even in high school arts programs, it's very rare to find a female media teacher.
Mm-hmm.
We had, you know, we sold out immediately of 30 girls for that first summer, and we had 60 professional women who wanted to come and volunteer for camp.
Wow, so after that
first year, it was like, oh, I think we're on to something. And the girls made 6 short films, 2 of which were entered in and accepted in film festivals around the country just that first week of camp. So it's clear that there's so much energy and excitement around creating change, around making sure young women and girls feel empowered to tell their own stories. And that's awesome. Like, this is hopefully will not be an uphill battle. This will be just a guiding towards change.
That's amazing. And you teach the whole filmmaking process in 1 week, from like script all the way to final edit and screening. I think that's really impressive to like take a whole little, you know, college course. Like, I went to school for film and video and animation, and like 4 years we learn all of these things, and you take the broad strokes and just, you know, teach it in 1 week. Like, even media literacy. I was so impressed last year when you had, I forget her name, but she came and talked about media literacy and why it's important and why we need to think about it. And I love all the lectures that you guys do during the camp. I think it's really well thought out and really important.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, again, I think it goes back to my philosophy on, how I produce, which is just set the standards high, and people will most likely and achieve what you, you know, like, this is where we're setting the bar. It's pretty rare that people want to come underneath that bar. I mean, you've been to camp, and you know that not all of our girls are 100% engaged, but most of them are, and it's true. It's a week in the summer, and it's hard, and yet 50% of them come back the next year. You know, and some of these girls are 13, 14 years old, and trust me, as a parent, your options for summer camp are endless. And so when we get girls coming for 3, this year we'll have our first graduating class coming back to volunteer, girls that are now in college and are doing film programs. It's really cool. It's just amazing to see what they're able to. You know, we tell them that we expect them to finish a film.
Mm-hmm.
And they do. No one has ever not.
You did a talk on Creative Mornings, I believe it was, about about Camp Real Stories. And I was really struck by when you talked about, like, young women finding their voice and knowing their worth, basically. And how, like, even though they're coming to camp for a week to learn the process of making a short film, they're also kind of learning self-worth and confidence.
Absolutely. I mean, I believe that that is really the great offering of Camp Real Stories. We have between 100, and this summer we'll probably have about 130 to 150 girls that come through Camp Real Stories during the summer. And I would love for all of them to say that they're going to have a career in the media. But the reality is that many of them are 13 and 14, 15 years old. I guess I had a little bit of an idea what I was going to do, but most people don't. But all of them need to feel confident speaking in public. All of them need to figure out how to tell a story. All of them need to figure out kind of how to sell their self-worth as they're applying to college, as they're moving their way through the world. And so all of those skills are going to be useful to them regardless of what they do. And at this day and age, when it's 2016, and we haven't moved the needle nearly as far as enough as we can for young women, and what the sort of issues that a lot of these girls are having to face on a daily basis, from sexual harassment to street harassment to true violence to just not being seen anywhere, I think the most revolutionary act that our young women can do is just take up space. And so if nothing else, when the girls leave camp, I want them to stand a little taller and talk a little louder and not feel that they have to listen to that voice in their head that's like, oh, don't say that thing out loud, because no one, you're going to be dumb if you do that, that there's no bad ideas. That's really all we want from them, is to take up a little bit more space and mm-hmm. say that they deserve to be there, because society keeps telling them that they don't. And we got 5 days to overcome that.
Mm-hmm. So last year, even from day one, I was surprised at the weight of some of the topics that at least the groups of girls that I was with on that first day of lectures, they were talking about like prostitution in the Oakland area for, you know, teenage girls. And I think that was like kind of a turning point. Well, like I knew the whole camp was important, but then I heard this discussion, and then after seeing also the documentaries that some of the teams made, I was just really surprised all of the topics that were on their minds that I wouldn't have thought they would have been thinking about. Like, also about, like, how, you know, girls are kind of, everyone wants them to be pretty, wear makeup, have, you know, be fit and athletic, and they were pointing these things out in their work and in the discussions. And I don't know, it was definitely heavier than I thought it would be.
Yeah, I mean, it, you know, I think when you get 30 teenage girls from such a wide variety of backgrounds that come to Camp Real Stories, you're going to get a wide variety of experiences. And that's one of the things that we love at camp, is seeing where what I always say, like, their Venn diagrams of their lives overlap. And, you know, a lot of our young women, not just the young women that come to camp, but just young women in our society, have experienced a huge lack of humanity at such a young age. And so, and they need to have the opportunity to be able to talk about it, because we don't give girls a lot of opportunity. We often dismiss how they're feeling, or that they're being hysterical or emotional. And that's one of the things that I think is so great about camp is, yes, a lot of these topics are weighty. But I've never had very few moments of girls just kind of losing it. Like, they know what's happened to them is not okay, and they just want to figure out how to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that's as simple as, like, I turn on the television and nobody looks like me or anybody I know, or something a lot more serious. I have friends that have been involved in sex trafficking in Oakland. I mean, these are all things that kind of tell you that you're worthless or that you're invisible. And so giving girls an opportunity to tell a story, and frankly, setting the bar again, it has to be a good story. It has to be a beginning, middle, and end. You have to be engaged with your audience and know what's out there, that it's not just visual poetry. They all rise to the occasion.
Mm-hmm. So, going back to having the lunch conversation about media literacy, why did you feel it was important to include it in the curriculum?
Well, I love media literacy. I love it more than anything in the entire world. I think it's just so important. We are inundated with media. Our young people, I mean, I work now even with younger kids, like work with fifth graders, and we just write down every type of media that they have access to. And, you know, half of them didn't exist a decade ago, if not less. You know, I mean, you look at YouTube and social media and all of these different things. And our schools are not teaching kids, giving kids the tools at all on how to decipher all of these different messages that they're getting. And what I find with a lot of media literacy out there as well is it can be very shaming around still kind of a little bit anti-media and telling girls that they shouldn't watch those things or they shouldn't do this and they shouldn't do that. And trust me when I tell you, as you know, and as a young woman, like, we need to stop telling young girls what they should and shouldn't do. Like, we should know that we should give them the tools that they can make those decisions on their own. So our media literacy program is really just about being able to, like, decipher what you're watching and make sure that you're walking away feeling good about yourself afterwards. I certainly, after a really rough, horrible day, or not so rough, horrible day, don't mind turning on some very mindless television, but I'm aware that why I'm watching it. I'm aware that I'm watching it because I just want to escape for a little while. But with our young people, they need to understand that reality TV is not so real. Or, you know, very simple things like count how many girls are on screen. Does that look anything like your life? Do you feel good about yourself after you've watched this? If you haven't, do you want to still watch it? But I think the key part is where are their key points for creating change? Because also, again, none of the media literacy makes any difference if you're not giving them solutions. So that's really what we do is, like, give them tools so as they're creating their own stories, they can figure out ways to combat the stereotypes and tropes that they are, you know, that's foisted upon them in the current media all the time. Because it's also, it's just boring. So bored of seeing all the same stuff, and that's what's so exciting when we see these girls working on these projects. That they're so much more interesting. Mm-hmm. And as a media lover and consumer, I want less boredom and more interesting.
Yeah, definitely. So, do you have like future plans to expand to other cities with Camp Real Stories?
We are hoping to have an L.A. camp this summer, or at least an L.A. workshop, and more spaces in the Bay Area, and then hopefully by 2017 there'll be a Camp Real Stories L.A. and a Camp Real Stories New York and a Camp Real Stories Bay Area. So that's the hope.
That'd be amazing.
And we would love to be in other places as well as we're trying to figure out what that looks like.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So where can people find out more about Camp Real Stories?
You can go to our website, which is campreelstory.com, and you can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And on those, both of those, both mostly Facebook and our website, you can also figure out ways that you can volunteer or get involved in other ways. We're always looking for additional ambassadors that want to help us create change in the media industry.
And as a volunteer, I highly recommend it because it is amazing. I felt like I walked out of there a better person with more drive, even.
Which is hard because you're a pretty great person to start off with.
So
you would want to be so bad, you thought that we made you better. I don't know.
I love it.
The bar pretty high on that.
Oh, I felt like I did a terrible job, but I felt better about myself afterwards.
You did a great job. You had a tough team.
Thank you. So, do you have any advice on how to pay it forward to future women following in our passions and footsteps?
Absolutely. I would say don't set aside your own hopes, dreams, and expectations because you feel like you have to fit into a box. I think this is the most exciting thing that can happen at this point in our careers is that the industry is changing under our feet. So take risks and collaborate, figure out who your circle of influence is, help other women because it will only come back tenfold to you. But also push yourself, especially at any time. You know, I think that women are told once they have a family that it's, you know, your career is harder. We can be very hard on working mothers. I have two kids. I would be less of a mother if I didn't work. I I love what I do, and I love them, and it's okay. you know, not every day is okay, but for the overall, it's okay. So I think it's really important to figure out and to know that maybe today you don't know what you're doing, but to just try to keep moving forward, because there is no one path, and it's going to be okay, even if it feels a little uncertain at times.
Oh, thank you, Esther. I'm going to write that down and put it on my desk. I love that.
Oh, thank you, Kathy. This is really fun.
Thank you, Esther. I really appreciate you coming on. I really, like, you're amazing, and I'm really happy to interview you on the podcast.
Oh, well, the love fest is mutual, so thank you very much.
Thanks to Esther Pearl for coming on the show. Please check out Camp Real Stories website. You can find them on the web at camprealstories.com, and that's real spelled R-E-E-L. If you know someone who would benefit from this camp, they have 2 sessions for beginners running this summer. So definitely check out the website to see when that is. I love, 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 love this organization and what they are doing. When I was growing up in a small rural town in Illinois, I wish I had anything close to this to empower me on how important my voice is and how much I am worth. I also wish I knew how to decipher the media, too. And in this camp, they actually have a whole talk on media literacy, which, like, I didn't really know that existed, you know, like, a little bit from college, you know, but they're very direct and all the information is solid. It was really amazing. I felt like I was learning just as much as the girls were, and it was such an experience. It really made my 2015. A lot of things changed for me after that. And I mean, I started this podcast. Esther Pearl is such an inspiration, you know, go, you know, do the things you want to do and go in it full-heartedly. Go with it with a full heart. I don't even know what I'm saying anymore. But the thing is, what you feel called to do is important, and you just have to trust yourself and trust that you are capable of these great things that you want to do. And if you are thinking about starting a project, whether that's a podcast, an animated short, or just a drawing even, like, just do it. Like, you are the most important person, and you deserve to have your voice heard. Obviously, be nice to other people too, but I hope you understand my intention and what I am saying. But yeah, check out all of the short films on the Camp Real Stories website. It's pretty amazing to see how mature some of these films are for teenage girls. It's just cool to see what's on their mind. As always, if you want to get in touch with me with feedback or suggestions, please email inkandpaintgirlspodcast@gmail.com. Music is courtesy of TV's Kyle. And finally, the views expressed on this podcast are our own and do not represent those of the Walt Disney Company. This has been the Ink and Paint Girls podcast. Thanks for tuning in.